which is to talk a bit about the self and the ego, which we did talk about in conversation with yesterday. So another aspect of traditional Buddhism here is the Anatta doctrine, which is sometimes I think a bit misleadingly called the no-self doctrine. And my experience is that accounts of Anatta in Buddhism vary a bit. So the cruder accounts at least make it look like the Buddhism wants to deny the self or say that there is no self. But if you do read more sophisticated accounts or hear more sophisticated accounts, they do make it a bit clearer that it's more a question of being agnostic about the self, that it's neither stating that there is not a self nor that there is a self, but that we cannot justifiably conclude either. And that second interpretation seems to be much more compatible with the middle way, given the issues about metaphysics, which we discussed a bit yesterday. Tim was asking about this yesterday, that sort of what exactly I mean by the idea of the self as a metaphysical object. As I understand it, it's that if there being something essential which is me and which is fixed, which I identify with and say that's essential, that's non-negotiable, that's and that in a sense wouldn't be a problem in itself if we didn't sort of apply it in ways which made it a problem. Let's take a very simple example. Supposing I'm a father, and if I think of myself as a father, and then my daughter leaves home, as she will be in a year or two, then, and I still hang on to that idea of myself as a father, then I'm not going to be able to adapt to the new conditions. I'll still be a father in a sense, obviously, but not so much of a father. It won't be so much to the fore in my experience. There are lots of examples of that from that simple example too. Things like, say, a child who's been maltreated, losing their sense of self-worth or whatever, because they've got a fixed sense of themselves as not being worthy because of the way they've been treated. Mm-hmm. So psychology is full of these sorts of examples. So this observation about the self is also found in Western philosophy, and Hume, said things about the self which have been interpreted as sort of denial of the self, but a more kind of charitable interpretation of them might be that he shows the lack of justification for believing positively in a fixed self. So Hume observed that when we try and find ourselves, if we just observe our mental processes, what we find is a load of mental processes. So we find a lot of thoughts, we find a lot of feelings about this and that. But if you sift through those thoughts and feelings, as it were, internally, and think, well, which of those is me? Actually, all you find is an assumption that each of those is mine. So that's my thought, that's my feeling. Then there's another set of arguments, which I don't want to go into in great detail, but I can mention them, that the idea that our overall experience in relation to the body determines us as being a self. So obviously we do have a particular perspective on the world, which is driven by the fact that we have one body and one perspective and one brain to process what we experience. Obviously that does set parameters to our experience. It structures our experience. But it shouldn't be confused with the idea of a self as a, you know, an essential experience, which is me. The philosopher Kant made that distinction, so he called that sort of structuring of our experience a perception, as opposed to the self of experience.
A perception is one word.
Yeah, so A-P-P.
A-P, yeah.
So, I'm going to suggest instead here that better approach to this it does build on what I think is an intelligent interpretation of the Buddhist approach, is that we do encounter consistently a wish to be a self, but we don't actually encounter a self. So we encounter an ego. And that's the projection that we come across when we sift through and find thoughts and feelings that we identify as ours. The my is projected onto that experience. So the ego is sort of like a big internal projector, I suppose, that it projects minus onto the blank screen of whatever we're experiencing. And that may be things we're experiencing internally, sort of like my thought, or it might be things we experience externally, so it might be my chair or my house or whatever. And obviously, the fact that the ego's doing that doesn't prove that it isn't mine. It may be, but it's just that claim about it being ultimately mine, in some sense, is not something we can really know about. And in the process, the ego also projects features onto the world generally, in accordance with our purposes. Now, this is perhaps a crucial point about the relationship between desires and beliefs. And this links in with some stuff I'm going to talk about later about the brain and the left and right halves of the brain. Supposing you think about perhaps going back to early times of early humans, somebody wants to crack a nut and they see a stone on the ground. Now, up to that point, the stone on the ground has been a stone. You know, their version of the world has included, maybe if they've noticed it at all, a stone down there. But then, once they've got this need to crack a nut, that stone then becomes a potential nutcracker. So they're understanding of the world has changed slightly, that their understanding of what it is has changed, in a sense, because of those purposes. And obviously the same can be applied to looking at a forest, or looking at a view where we pick out what's important to us or what's useful to us. So you might be looking at the edge of the forest, but actually you're scanning for predators rather than just taking in everything equally in that view. And this is all to do with the ego, really. So it's our purposes. It's my life preservation at a basic level, or my, things I want to achieve or do, which drive the way I structure my understanding of the world. So that's why the ego is made up of identifications and projections. Those projections also are not necessarily aligned with the individual. So those projections may or may not be to do with me as an individual body. Very often they are, roughly speaking. And we do tend to identify with our bodies on the whole most of the time, and we feel something bad has happened when we hurt parts of our body and so on, but there are also lots of interesting cases of those that line being changed. So alienation from parts of the body is one interesting one. So there's a great book by Oliver Sacks called A Leg to Stand On, where he gives this account of this accident he had to his leg, after which he became alienated from his leg and felt it wasn't part of him and he wanted it removed. And there are people who have this condition. But he's actually a neurologist, so he was able to write about it with a lot of understanding of what was going on. So we don't necessarily identify with our bodies. We don't necessarily identify even with our minds or our internal experience, and hence, the psychological disturbance is where we become alienated from ourselves and hate ourselves. So not only do we not necessarily identify with ourselves as individuals, but we also obviously identify with other things beyond ourselves, particularly the strongest ones are things like partners and children and so on. So that's one of the, I think particularly again my experience as a parent has driven that home to me. I think that how strongly one identifies with the child, that it's almost like identifying with a part of yourself sometimes, particularly when they're very small. And obviously that tapers off as you go further out, that there's a world out there where I've got lots of identifications. I'd prefer the rebels in Syria to beat Assad or whatever. I've still got an identification out there. My ego is even going that far. That's what leads me to this assertion, which we discussed a bit yesterday, that I don't think the ideas of selfishness or selflessness are at all helpful, morally speaking. What is morally significant to us is only contingently or broadly anything to do with what's in my interest as an individual or not. So, instead, I'd suggest that it's the working with the identifications of the ego, whatever they are, that's important morally. The projections of the ego change over time. And this is another aspect of the way the ego works, that at one moment I may identify with something different from another moment. And obviously the longer the time, the more likely it is that those identifications will have changed. We can change our minds about people we like or dislike, or things that we believe or don't believe. But the funny thing about the ego is that this persistent delusion, this belief each time that we identify with something that's really it, that's really true, that's how things really are. So the ego kind of works against provisionality all the time. So it's constantly tugging against recognition of the fact that things are going to change, or that we've got lots of other energies within us than the ones we have to have now. So that's why the ego is a source of conflict between desires. So you can think of that in a variety of ways. That the things I want now. So the example of the chocolate biscuits that we had yesterday. That I want chocolate biscuits, but there may be another bit of meat that doesn't. I may because of my desire to lose weight or something, repress my desire for chocolate biscuits. I may even not become conscious of that desire. So the mechanisms of the unconscious may be one way in which the ego works to, you know, to stop some of our desires from even reaching our awareness. But you don't necessarily have to get into talk of the unconscious to understand the ego. So I think it's just the fact that different desires pop up at different times and we're just not consistent. All I think that's really needed to grasp the idea of the ego is that, just the recognition that we are variable. And hence that there are conflicts between our desires at different times. So if we try and think of ourselves over time rather than just now, so what you could technically call a synchronic view, over time view of ourselves, I think that's part of what's involved in developing awareness, that we try and understand ourselves in the past and ourselves in the future, understand those identifications and how they're changing, and in that process we become a bit bigger, stretch the ego a bit.